Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world. Online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You want to know whether high gas prices are changing consumer behavior? All right, how about this? We got May auto sales today, and for the first month since 1992, Ford is moving more cars than trucks. Detroit has been trying to change its ways for years now. $4 gas just might have done it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity. Online at us.areva.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you with us today. And we will note, just for the record, that the nationwide average for a gallon of gas stands at $3.98 on this third day of June. Bearing that in mind, the May sales figures from Detroit's big three car makers that we got today come as no surprise at all. Chrysler lost 25%. Ford, maker of the mighty F-Series pickup truck, lost 16%. General Motors was down 28%, which contributed to this announcement from the company this morning. It's going to close four factories where it makes trucks and SUVs. It's going to offload or perhaps completely retool the Hummer brand and in the process save $1 billion a year. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more.
Love is strange. Remember that Super Bowl commercial where a groaning monster gives birth to a tiny Hummer? No love is stranger than the American love affair with a big car. Now consumers are telling GM it's over. They have a new passion, hybrids.
Toyota Prius. Have a nice future.
But wasn't the future obvious? GM CEO Rick Wagner says there's no way GM could have anticipated how fast gas prices would rise and GM sales would plummet. Late last year, GM was selling more than 100,000 trucks and SUVs per month. And then,
over the last couple of months, that average has gone down to about 65,000 units.
Auto industry analyst Kevin Tynan says GM was too busy treading water to think about the future.
And you're basically doing all you can to keep pickups and SUVs in front of the consumer because that's what you need to sell to be able to cover your costs.
While GM treaded water, consumers were kicking the tire treads on the Prius and buying. Wagner said today that GM will make more hybrids and small cars. It'll sell an electric car by late 2010. But analyst Pete Hastings of Morgan Keegan says GM will have to work faster.
Hopefully they're just trying to manage expectations and maybe deliver a little bit more than they're communicating so far.
GM has made one thing clear. The shift away from SUVs is permanent. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
I don't want to overplay the move away from trucks to small cars that today's numbers suggest, but Ford's F-Series has been the number one selling vehicle in this country, big or small, car or truck, for 23 years in a row now. The financial fallout from the subprime mortgage mess continues to rain down upon Wall Street. The latest anxiety comes from reports that Lehman Brothers, Wall Street's smallest independent investment bank, is suffering higher than expected losses. To shore up its books, Lehman scraped together $4 billion in new capital over the past quarter. But Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports that may not be enough.
Lehman is reportedly planning to raise another $3 or $4 billion by either selling more stock or accepting investments from overseas sovereign wealth funds. Either one would dilute the value of its current shares, and some analysts have downsized their forecasts of Lehman's future performance.
I wouldn't predict any imminent danger for Lehman.
Columbia University's John Coffey says accumulating capital may merely be Lehman's way of making itself more expensive and therefore less attractive to buy.
Lehman is uniquely positioned as the last independent investment bank that's within the range of the takeover market. And by raising capital, it makes that at least marginally more difficult.
But Lehman's problems point out that Wall Street banks still hold lots of shaky mortgage loans. The Federal Reserve has been lending banks plenty of cash to head off short-term problems, but University of Maryland business professor Peter Morici isn't sure that'll be enough.
The question is, can the Fed buy them enough time to rebuild their businesses? These banks do have solid businesses. However, they've been engaged in so many inappropriate practices and so many aspects of their business that they have to fundamentally change the way they operate.
Morici and other economists also worry that if cash-strapped consumers stop borrowing for cars, education, and shopping, banks could face even tougher times, which means predictions that the worst is over may be premature. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Ben Bernanke got the business day started with a bang. The Fed chairman gave a speech this morning. Didn't say so outright, but definitely left the impression he's not much in the mood to cut interest rates anymore. Said he's worried about oil prices and, yeah, inflation. It's been just over a year since the mandatory health insurance program in Massachusetts went into effect and got its first checkup today. And Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has the results.
Healthcare reformers see Massachusetts as a sort of laboratory for universal coverage. No other state has adopted such a comprehensive plan. And if it's successful, advocates hope it will embolden Congress to pass something similar. Today's study by the Urban Institute suggests, so far at least, the Massachusetts plan is working. Sharon Long led the research.
Uninsurance is down among working-age adults, reduced by almost half. Access to care has improved, and health care is more affordable for individuals in the state.
The Massachusetts law requires residents to buy health insurance or pay a yearly penalty. The state subsidizes those who can't afford coverage. But the plan isn't entirely the picture of health. The research suggests there may not be enough primary care doctors to service all the newly insured. And the program cost at least $150 million more than expected. Drew Altman is president of the Kaiser Family Foundation.
There's not a lot of cost containment built into the Massachusetts plan.
Altman says controlling costs is now the law's biggest challenge, especially given the weak economy. Some healthcare advocates are already calling for employers to contribute more towards the program. Not surprisingly, business is resisting that remedy.
Really a dangerous move for the future of the economy of the state of Massachusetts.
Bill Vernon is with the National Federation of Independent Business. He says anything that would upset the delicate political balance achieved in the Massachusetts plan is unwise. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
From health policy to something, well, less healthy now, cigarettes. The price of a smoke in New York City shot up today after a new $1.25 statewide tax hike went into effect. That makes state taxes on cigarettes $2.75 a pack now. Throw in city taxes, and a pack of smokes is now topping $10 in some stores. Marketplace's Jill Barshay went for a walk in the Big Apple to see how smokers and sellers are reacting.
$10.25.
What do you think?
I think that's unreal.
So what are you going to do?
Going to go to the corner.
Can I come with you?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to go see if they're a little cheaper. Hey, can I have a pack of Marlboro, please?
$8.75.
Thanks. It's a little better.
A lot of people get shocked with the news that it's much more expensive. It hasn't reached exactly $10, but it's close enough there, and I'm sure it'll raise anytime soon.
I think they're ridiculously high. Smoking is still a choice, and We shouldn't be penalized because of our choices, and especially not by the state. But I don't know. I guess I'm going to have to cut back because otherwise I won't be able to afford it.
It's an addiction. You can't help it.
But I buy a pack every Friday, and I know a spot to sell it for $9.
So are you going to buy less? What are you going to do?
I'm going to start smoking. I'm going to quit smoking.
Really?
Yep.
Because I don't want to quit smoking right now, but I'm being forced to because of the price.
Smoke them if you got them, I guess. Oil and the dollar continued their fancy footwork today. The dollar rose on those Bernanke comments I mentioned. Oil dribbled down more than $3, almost $3.50 in point of fact. Wall Street didn't care much for either development. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's going to be more on the line during the Olympics later this summer than just who's going to win the most medals. At $20 billion and counting, the facelift that Beijing's giving itself to get ready for the Games might be the most expensive ever for a host country. Standard & Poor's said today it thinks all that spending will be a net plus for the Chinese economy. For Olympic sponsors, though, the bottom line is not so clear. Companies pay handsomely for the right to use the rings, but unauthorized copycats have made for a marketing muddle. As Marketplace's Scott Tong reports now from Beijing.
Let's play Name the Olympic Sponsor. Is it Nike, whose billboards in Beijing show Chinese hurdler Liu Xiang crouching at the starting line? Is it Adidas, with its own crouching athletes and posters that proclaim impossible is nothing? Or is it the shoemaker claiming everything is possible? That would be Chinese upstart Li Ning. The answer? Adidas. Now, if you didn't get it right, neither did 25-year-old Yang Xiaodan, a self-proclaimed veteran Beijing shopper.
Last night I saw a TV ad for a medical product. It's not connected to the Olympics, but it had athletes running. So I immediately thought about the Olympics.
Not good news for sponsors who've ponied up as much as $100 million to use Olympic logos in their ads and to give their own brands global TV exposure during the Games. Marketing consultant David Wolf says rivals pay nothing to the Olympics organizers, yet use what he calls ambush marketing to piggyback on all the excitement. Today, the IOC's local partner, the Beijing Organizing Committee, pledged to root out advertisers who misleadingly suggest association with the Games. Chen Feng is with the Beijing Committee.
We will identify cases of infringement and seek out those companies. If they don't stop, we will seek legal actions, including fines, and we will ask the media to expose them.
Even if he succeeds, the rules still leave a whole lot of space for non-sponsors to operate. For instance, Nike sponsors specific athletes, like Liu Xiang, the hurdler. Footwear maker Li Ning outfits Chinese sportscasters, plus the entire Olympic basketball team of Argentina. All this marketing noise has some companies wondering if Olympic sponsorships are worth it anymore. Marketing consultant David Wolf.
When you have companies like Lenovo, who, as IBM before it, has been a long-time sponsor of the game, saying, hey guys, after summer 2008, we're done. You have to understand that the question is already being asked in some circles.
Still, Will Moss of the PR firm Burson Marsteller says if a sponsor is in it for the long haul, Olympic advertising can have a cumulative effect.
If working with the Olympics helps to feed into people's perceptions of the brand and whether they think it's cool or whether they think it's desirable or not, then the sponsor is getting something positive, even if those associations are sometimes subconscious.
At the conscious level, that theory is in question. In one poll, the timeless Pepsi versus Coke battle came into play. 60% of respondents assumed Pepsi was the sponsor. They were wrong. In Beijing, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Earlier this year, the Olympic story was mostly about one part of China. A government crackdown in Tibet disrupted the torch relay in many cities around the world. Next month marks 3 years since the first run of a train from Beijing to the Tibetan capital of Lhasa, a train built for political reasons, but also in part for economic ones. Abram Lustgarten has ridden those rails. He writes about it in his new book. It's called China's Great Train. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here.
This train leaves Beijing from the West train station, arrives at Lhasa a number of days later. What's it like getting on that train in Beijing and then getting off, 17,000 feet up in the air, a couple of thousand miles away?
Mm-hmm. It's totally amazing. I wrote in the book that I experienced China's trains as a sort of time machine, that you start in Beijing, and Beijing's a modern metropolis, and it kind of seems like no big deal. The train seems sort of antiquated almost. And as you head further east through these developing cities, you progress into a more and more rural and less developed China, and the train sort of emerges as this more and more modern experience. And by the time you get to Golmud, the northern step of the Kunlun Mountains, and up onto the plateau, you might as well be on the moon. You're in a completely different world.
Is there something out there that Beijing wants, or is it just that it's out there and they wanted it?
I believe there's a lot out there they want. The resources that are believed to be on the Tibetan Plateau are astronomical, large deposits of copper and iron. They say there's quite a bit of oil and gas, though the reserves aren't quite proven. And then there's a slew of other metals, from gold to lithium. The estimates for the value of resources in Tibet are in the hundreds of billions of dollars. And there's also the geopolitical importance of controlling Tibet's the gateway to the rest of South Asia, to Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Nepal, and all of these countries that China wants to influence in order to secure themselves against their competition in India.
One of the economic stories about China in the past decade or so, and the story that we told when we were there a couple of years ago, is this push by the government to get economic development out west. Mm-hmm. Is this train the next logical extension of that?
I think it's definitely part of it. Whether it's logical, I'm not sure. But yeah, fixing the disparity between China's rich and poor and east and west was a primary objective. And Tibet's an eighth of China's land mass. If you include Tibetan ethnic areas, it's a quarter of China's land mass, and it's largely empty and it's largely rural. So if you do want to expand and you want to fill up space and you want to mitigate the overcrowding in eastern cities, that's a logical place to go.
Who's benefiting from the economic development, though? Is it Han Chinese, the majority ethnic group, or are Tibetans actually getting the jobs that are being developed in Lhasa and Tibet?
The caveat is there are some Tibetans who are benefiting. There's a rising Tibetan middle class, but it's very small, and the vast majority of the benefits of this development are not only going to Han Chinese, but often to Chinese corporations that are outside of Tibet and have nothing to do with Tibet. And even the profits that do stay in Tibet are going largely to Chinese-owned businesses and Chinese employers and Chinese employees. And Tibetans are having a difficult time getting jobs, even at professional levels.
Play it out for me then, 3, 5, 10 years in the future. What does Lhasa look like after a decade with this train service?
My fear is that unless drastic steps are taken to kind of alter the course of development in Lhasa, which is possible because the culture is valued from both the Chinese and Tibetan perspective, that Lhasa will look like any other growing Chinese city. It saw 1.2 million tourist visitors when I started reporting for this book. By the time I finished, it was getting about 2.5 to 3 million, and they're projecting 10 million by the end of next year. So the influx of people is astronomical, and the influx of investment and permanent migration and new settlers is on par with that.
The book by Abram Lustgarten is called China's Great Train, Beijing's Drive West and the Campaign to Remake Tibet. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, taste in a test tube?
Using much of the same technologies that the biotech industries use to discover medicines, we're using to discover new flavors.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials clicked down 0.8% today, 100 points, to end the day at 12,402. The NASDAQ lost 0.4%, 11 points, finished at 2480. The S&P 500 subtracted 0.4%, 5 points there, closed at 1379. We told you earlier about Lehman Brothers capital woes. Shares of the securities giant bled 9.5% on that news. While Covia is still smarting from its board's ouster of CEO Ken Thompson yesterday, its stock hit a 52-week low, down 6.3% on the session. ExxonMobil slid 2.3% on talk of softer demand for oil. Chevron and ConocoPhillips each slipped around 1.5%. It was a foul day for Tyson Foods. That's F-O-U-L and F-O-W-L, by the way. The nation's number two chicken producer balked 8% on news that a flock of breeder hens was exposed to a strain of bird flu. Not the bad one, though. Let me say that again. Not the bad one. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing firsthand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the first quarter productivity report. The Senate Judiciary Committee holds a hearing on the handling of terrorism detainees in the U.S. judicial system. And Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice releases the annual report on human trafficking. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
As we've been going through the emails that have come in over the past couple of weeks, it has been hard to miss a general theme y'all seem to have on your minds. Whether it relates to what you drive or how often, the high price of air travel, or government regulations on greenhouse gases, there are a lot of people out there preoccupied by energy prices. Shocker. I know. Richard Johnson of Arlington, Virginia, wrote in about a ride I took in an electric car a couple of weeks ago. Our car guy, Dan Neal from the Los Angeles Times, had gotten his hands on a little thing called a Zen car. That's zero emissions, no noise. Mr. Johnson thought Dan and I poked a little bit too much fun.
You refer to it as perfect for retirement communities and for old people, but not practical for the general public until gas is $10 a barrel in 5 or 10 years. As long as the mainstream media continue to regard electric car technology as something that only exists and will only exist on the fringes, nothing is going to change.
Ren Schultz is a computer programmer from Anacortes, Washington, who's not even bothering with electric. He's given up driving altogether and was therefore unimpressed by our mention of a guy who went without gas for a month.
You pointed out some fella in Wisconsin who decided to give up gasoline for 31 days. To me, while this is laudable, it's totally unremarkable. I voluntarily gave up my car 2 years ago and donated it to public radio, and have survived exclusively on public transportation since then.
Despite all the hand-wringing over pump prices this spring, oil has actually dropped since Memorial Day, thanks in part, says Stephen Gilmore from Charlotte, North Carolina, to fewer drivers and thus lower demand.
This is how the free market works, and why no government intervention is necessary to bring down the price of gas.
It's planes and trains as well as automobiles when you're talking about the high price of oil. Airlines are passing on some of their costs to passengers in the form of extra fees and surcharges. Our report about American Airlines charging $15 for the first checked bag got Daniel Eldridge thinking.
Perhaps what's needed is a multi-tiered approach along the lines of the car rental companies. One fee to check bags in, another fee to check bags out. Heck, some airlines might have a different fee structure for bags that accompany you on your flight versus bags that go at a different time or by rail.
Who knows? Might work. Kidding aside, if he was kidding, if you have a comment about something you hear on the program, head to our homepage. It's marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. The United Nations held a summit in Rome today to talk about the global food crisis. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called for an end to import tariffs and to the export bans that some countries have imposed to protect their domestic supplies. He also said it's going to take as much as $20 billion a year to cope with rising global demand. Scientists are experimenting with new technologies to help increase crop yields and meet that demand, but they're also working on another part of the food chain at the same time. Janet Babin reports now from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio on the business of flavor.
There used to be only one way to create new flavors, with a chef and a couple of taste testers. But the flavor industry hit a wall. Product development took too long. Consumers demanded taste sensations without added salt, sugar, fat, or cost. Enter science to the rescue. Sonomix is a flavor company based in San Diego. But inside, it looks a lot more like a pharmaceutical lab than a test kitchen.
Using much of the same technologies that the biotech industries use to discover medicines, we're using to discover new flavors.
That's Sonomic's chief scientist, Mark Zoller. So far, researchers know humans can experience five tastes: sweet, salty, sour, bitter, and the fifth taste, umami, or savory. Well, Sonomic isolated the human taste bud receptors that let us distinguish these tastes. Again, here's Mark Zoller.
We build sort of an artificial taste bud, if you will, and what this allows us to do is to screen different potential flavor ingredients against these receptors.
The pseudo-taste bud doesn't look impressive, just an oversized petri dish, really, loaded with flavor samples that get popped into a big metal machine. But the system is actually more sensitive than our tongues. It can identify new flavors faster than you can swallow that chocolate bacon bonbon. Sonomic starts with ingredients pulled from all kinds of sources: flowers, plants, minerals, chemicals. Joe Cohen built the sample system from scratch.
This is a thermoscientific plate sealer, and this is an apricot liquid handler.
You ever get these on eBay?
To believe it or not, I bought this barcode scanner on eBay.
Then the sample plates are mixed with human taste receptor cells. Guy Cervantes, director of high throughput screening, he's in charge of the cells.
The system can then take all these samples, put them onto the cells, and we measure in real time here on this computer screen how the cells are responding to the samples.
Cervantes tests as many as 50,000 flavors a day. Finding that rare flavor, though, is just the beginning. Sweet in the lab could turn sour in the kitchen. Sonomic didn't let me watch its taste panel in action. Privacy concerns. The flavor enhancer market is worth $6 billion a year, according to the Fredonia Group, so secrecy is key. But the company's Janice Smith put my taste buds to the test.
Here's your water and your spit cup.
Spit cup?
Yes.
You're not supposed to swallow what's in the little plastic cups. It could be a substance the FDA has yet to approve. For my test, I had to discern which of two samples was sweeter, and the difference between them was just 2%.
Most people don't realize that tasting can be a science and that it is pretty difficult to be a taster.
But the tasters at Sonomic have figured it out. The company created a new flavor enhancer that can cut the amount of sucralose in products by up to 75%. Not a bad find at a time when consumers want less sugar and food companies are dealing with spiraling sweetener costs. Sonomic also patented a replacement for the savory flavor. It's used in noodle bowls sold around the world. Discoveries like these helped Sonomic double its revenues over last year. Next up, a cooling ingredient. It can make room temperature soda feel ice cold in your mouth. In San Diego, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, now it's personal. Carl Icahn said today he's had about enough of Yahoo CEO Jerry Yang and he wants him gone. Icahn's in the middle of a proxy fight for control of Yahoo's board, which is set to meet today, by the way. Icahn tells the Wall Street Journal court documents released yesterday show Yang and Yahoo were trying to torpedo Microsoft's takeover bid even before it was formally made. Yahoo said none of that is true. Microsoft didn't say a thing. I now have to say this, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 100 points, 0.8%. The Nasdaq lost 11 points. That's 0.4%. The S&P 500 fell 5 points, rather. That's also 0.4%. Miguel Macias works the overnight for the Marketplace Morning Report. The Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, healing from head to toe.
If you understand the cultural background, the living experience, the lifestyle of your patient, you can better treat your patient.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.